everybody. This is the Android Central podcast for May 11, 2017. We are only a few days away from Google I.O., and that is what we're going to be talking about today, along with some very cool new phone hype, some new phones coming down the pipe. That is light. Nope. I got nothing. But I do have two very interesting, charming, and very good-looking people with me today. I'm joined by Alex Dobie, all the way from the United Kingdom. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good, and good to be back on the podcast. It's been a few weeks.
It has been. I think you're always in video land, and this is an audio medium, so we got to get you doing more of this.
Yeah, there's like a mental switch that I need to flip somewhere so to get back into audio, but it's good to be back.
Well, it's also good to welcome back Jerry Hildenbrand. Back from the land of Key One. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm pretty well. I had a scare today with my dog. She was bitten. It was a little bit frightening. I'll be honest. When the things you love get hurt, you want to protect them, and you want to get angry. And it was a scary afternoon, but she's okay.
Good.
So. Dogs That's are why we're doing too. This a little bit late. Yeah, exactly. Dogs are people. And are phones people? I don't know. Maybe. A little bit.
Yeah.
They're becoming more and more part of us. I mean, if you watch the Microsoft Build keynote today, this was day two, and Satya Nadella, Microsoft CEO, was talking a lot about the interconnectedness of everything and how they're not going to focus on smartphones anymore. They're mainly just going to focus on making all of the devices, whether they run Android, iOS, or Windows, talk to each other. So that's smart. It is smart. It's also probably going to be an element. There's going to be elements of that at Google I.O. next week.
Yep.
And we'll get to that a little bit later. But let's start with some phones. There's one phone that we know that's coming fairly soon. It's the HTC something or other, Alex. HTC 11, HTC U 11, HTC
Ocean,
11 U.
HTC Ocean. I don't. Yeah.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, so the it's the, yeah. The, it's the successor to last year's HTC 10. It's the HTC 2017 flagship. The rumored name, according to Evan Blass, is HTC U 11, which is kind of this collision of last year's branding coming on from the HTC 10 and obviously bringing in the U name, because supposedly it's continuing in this U family, which is the product line for HTC's flagship phones now. So the one thing that we know for sure about it, we can take a guess at the specs, and there have been like pictures of the box leaked which show us some entirely predictable things like Snapdragon 835, 4 or 6 gigs of RAM depending on which benchmarks you believe. But the big sort of hyped thing for this phone, the thing that's been appearing in a lot of HTC's teasers, is this like squeeze input where you can squeeze the phone and it recognizes that and does things.
Yeah, what's up with that? That's a strange feature, and that's a feature, Jerry, that we saw sort of leaked in a it was almost like a marketing video.
So it was
from last year.
Sorry to interrupt Jerry on this, but this was actually an internal pitch within HTC. So you had a team working on pitching this feature to the executive level, and that is where that video came from. It appeared on someone's personal portfolio, and now what we see in these teasers is the consumer implementation of that. What do you think of that, Jerry?
I don't know, man.
He didn't just take a sip of delicious Coca-Cola.
No,
this podcast is sponsored by Coca-Cola.
I want it to be good, but I'm afraid it's not going to be.
You know what else responds when you squeeze it? A button.
Yeah.
Ah, fancy that. Does Bixby respond when you squeeze it? Because I don't know about
actually,
that.
Actually, it kind of doesn't sometimes, because and this is a weird aside, but if you notice that if you hold the Bixby button too long, it actually doesn't do anything. Because
that's true.
They have the long press, which in Korea activates the voice thing, but outside Korea, it's like they just commented out that code or something. So if you do a short, if you do a very short press, it responds with the Bixby screen. If you do a long press or press it for too long, it does literally nothing.
I think if you long press it, it sends all your passwords to Hewlett Packard.
Well, at least if you have two-factor authentication, you should be safe. Right, Jerry?
Well, yeah. Yeah, safe is relative.
It's but true.
Yes, use two-factor on everything.
All right,
guys,
so
girls.
Alex,
yeah.
I mean, let's talk about this design, because if it is the same design as the Uplay and U-Ultra, it seems, and I've never held a U-Ultra, so I don't know, but it seems a little, I don't know, fragile to me. Is that just my imagination? Is this basically just the same, you know, just a variant of the metal and glass design that we're used to already from Samsung and LG?
In a way. I mean, they wouldn't have used the U brand if they weren't planning on bringing forward some of the design language that they established earlier in the year with the Uplay and the Ultra. That said, I'm not entirely convinced that doing this sort of back to front has benefited HTC in any way. You introduce a new brand, not with the flagship, which is coming later, but with these two weird phones. One, the Uplay, which is just this weird MediaTek-powered nothing of a phone that is still running Marshmallow. And the U-Ultra, which is like, I mean, I don't know. I don't know where this really fits in, but it's like they took bits of this year's phone and bits of last year's phone and kind of, you know, smashed the blueprints of it together and gave it to a bunch of chimpanzees and said, okay, make a phone that's kind of big because the Note 7 is no longer a thing. And eventually at the end of that process, we had the U-Ultra, which had kind of hints of a good phone in there. But at the same time, had these weird features like this secondary display, which, if the rumors are to be believed, isn't in the U11. So I think, you know, you would expect, based on the teasers that HTC's put out so far, to have metal and glass. Whether it feel, I mean, based on the U-Ultra, didn't necessarily feel fragile to me. It felt kind of big, hefty. You know, for a 5.7-inch phone, pretty large. We'll need to wait and see until we get hands-on with it, but you would imagine HTC has a long history in terms of, you know, build quality and design language. With their new flagship phone, they should be putting forth their A game, so you would hope that this thing feels solid, but we'll just have to wait and see.
Right. So, Jerry, you wrote a piece last year about, or maybe it was earlier this year, about how the HTC 10 was the sort of underground darling of last year.
Yep.
How it really was a better phone than people gave it credit for.
Yep.
I haven't picked it up in months, I'll admit it. And I'm sure, you know, current owners of the HTC 10 are probably enjoying a phone that's held up quite well. But if the HTC 11 or U11 is the successor, what can the company do to make it stand out other than this reported squeeze feature?
It's hard for HTC. I mean, if another company that gets more exposure, let's say a Samsung or even Huawei or, you know, other up and coming companies had made the HTC 10, had made the exact same phone, they would have sold a ton of them. It was a great phone. It did everything well. Just nobody knew, you know, nobody knew about it. It wasn't in any carrier stores. It just didn't sell. It's going to be the same problem. They have to have something that makes everybody say, oh, wow. And I don't think squeezing it is it.
You touched on the carrier side of things there, Jerry, and that's an important part as well, because especially in the UK, the HTC 10 was on 2 out of 4 carriers. Huawei with the P9 last year had all 4. You know, similar deal in the US, they didn't have Verizon with the HTC 10. So, yeah, it's going to be about not just having something to attract consumers, whether it's a, you know, new squeeze feature, which may just be there to get people in the door and get people interested in it.
Right.
Whether it's this glass design, which might fare better than just metal, which everyone is doing these days. But above and beyond that, in terms of the carrier relationship, they're going to have to improve upon that and have that there just to have a chance to sell this phone. And that's the chance the HTC 10 didn't really have, because the carrier side of that equation just wasn't there in both the UK and the US.
if you didn't read about Android phones on the internet, you didn't know the HTC 10 existed.
Yeah, I haven't seen a single HTC 10 in the wild. I've seen more OnePlus phones the past year than I've seen HTC phones.
And that's the biggest problem with HTC. You know, love them or hate them, we all are fans of certain things. They make quality products just as good as any other company. And they do what they're supposed to do, and they're quite nice, and nobody buys them because they're not anywhere where you can buy them.
And maybe that changes this year, maybe it doesn't. But that's going to be, yeah, it's going to be crucial to the success or otherwise of this phone.
Well, I mean, that also speaks to the saturation in the U.S. market. I know, Alex, you've spoken many times about how different the U.K. market is, and how, you know, there is really no particular issue with companies like Huawei, HTC selling their phones, you know, in carrier stores, because people don't really buy on subsidy or financing there. And a company like Huawei has a much bigger market share in England than in the US as a result. Do you want to just touch on that?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's necessarily to do with subsidy. I mean, subsidies work pretty much the same here as they do in the US. It's more about just the ease at which Huawei is, you know, being able to work their way into the UK market, whereas there are additional barriers to get into the US for, like, kind of semi-obvious reasons. I think, like, that additional competition in the UK, where you have not just all the competitors that they face in the US, but also Huawei, which has a ton of money to spend and is you know, going about establishing a foothold in Europe very aggressively and has been quite successful in doing that. So they're competing not only with, you know, Apple and Samsung, which are the two de facto, you know, the iPhone and the de facto alternative to the iPhone. You know, LG is still kicking around there. Huawei, you know, is... They're all competing with the same shelf space, and there is more competition for that shelf space in the UK. And don't forget, also in the UK and other parts of Europe now, OnePlus is slowly building out its carrier relationships. So there's another competitor they'll have to deal with this year. So it's not so much to do with the nature of the market being any different, but just the number of players that there are in that market.
Right, the entrenched players being so powerful. And you know, Apple is powerful in the UK and in Europe, but it isn't quite as powerful as it is in the US. You know, the iPhone has 50% or more market share in the US. Samsung fills out quite a lot of the rest, and LG apparently had its best quarter in quite a number of years, and now claims 20% market share of the smartphone market in the US. So there really isn't a lot of room left for smaller companies like HTC.
But at the same time, on a more optimistic note, just the fact that things can pendulum sort of back and forth between different manufacturers. I mean, everything sort of exists and has to live or die by this 1 to 2 year contract refresh cycle. So as much as selling phones is important, getting people bought into your ecosystem and getting people to, you know, buy your phone and keep buying your phones is also important. But that's also an opportunity for challengers, whether they're sort of underdogs like HTC or whether they're new entrants in the market like OnePlus. That's a chance that exists for everyone that is competing in every market.
I guess I just think that HTC is a very different beast than a company like OnePlus. OnePlus,
for sure.
Even though ostensibly they now, because of the paucity of carrier relationships in the US, they are essentially competing for the same you know, unlocked buyers, unlocked phones, smartphone buyers. They approach things very differently. I think HTC still wants to entrench itself in that traditional carrier market, you know, the carrier dominated market, where people go into the store and they choose between a number of established companies, whereas OnePlus has very much become a disruptor just by word of mouth in the US.
Yeah, and OnePlus is still, I mean, they're kind of coming out of the startup phase now, but that's where they came from, whereas HTC is taking, like you said, a much more traditional route where they're selling through the carriers and you'll buy it in a store and, okay, you can get it online as well, but that's not really primarily how they do things. Also, It's you've got to take into account just the size of the companies and the size of the infrastructure and organizations that they have to support with their sales. So OnePlus is still a very lean organization. They have offices in London, offices on the West Coast, close to the US, I think an office in India now, and an office in Shenzhen in China. And that's more or less it. And they are quite small offices. Whereas HTC has, you know, this big global infrastructure and huge headquarters all around the world. And it's just when you have to support that number of people and a company of that size, then there, you know, the requirement in terms of just generating revenue is that much greater.
It's important to remember that OnePlus is actually a division of one of the biggest electronics companies.
Not really a division.
They're finance. That's who gives them their money.
They're financed by this. You're talking about Oppo, right? So the
right.
And I've pressed senior people at OnePlus several times about this, and that the line they give me is that they are not owned by Oppo. They have access to the infrastructure that Oppo has in terms of manufacturing stuff, and they have the same investors as Oppo. For sure, that right. helps a hell of a lot. But it's kind of a different relationship if you look at Huawei and Honor, which, as much as they like to draw a line between the two, are very much the same company.
And that line is actually going to be more and more blurry this year, I think. You know, we're seeing Honor and Huawei, between Honor and Huawei.
Okay.
The P10 and P10 Plus, the Mate 9, those are certainly distinctive phones, but I'm guessing you'll see Honor play in a more high-end place in the market this year. I mean, that's just my guess, but the Honor 8 was far better than it had any reason to be. And even though it didn't do so well, I think from a sales perspective in the US, it was, I think, a good indicator where Huawei's growth strategy lies. You know, it's not, especially in the US.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where that goes. I think it probably will be a very different sort of strategy that they need to take in the US and in Europe. Because you got to remember, I mean, the big difference in Europe is they're not only competing with everyone else, they're competing with Huawei in Europe. And this is the crazy thing. You have carriers that will, you know, be, you know, Huawei and Honor will be pitching very similar phones to the same carriers, and that will potentially maybe cause problems from them on some levels. Whereas, you know, the issue in the US is more the fact that, okay, they're not going through the carrier route and the name is unknown and the software is a little bit weird. So, you know, that there are challenges facing them on both fronts, but the answer there maybe is different. So in the UK, maybe they go towards this more mid-range space, and we've seen more mid-range and entry-level Honor phones arriving in the UK, like the 6X, the 5C, that haven't really arrived to, you know, in a massive way in the US. Whereas in the US, it's more been about unlocked higher-end specs, and, you know, we'll see maybe with an Honor 9 later in the year if they continue in that way.
Right. I mean, and then we saw a little bit about the Nova series, which is expected to be refreshed later this month. And that was sort of that came out of left field for you a little bit last year, because the Nova and Nova Plus, the Plus took its design language from the Nexus 6P, but it was, both of the phones were very much mid-range devices that, mm-hmm. I wasn't sure where they fit in.
So the, let me just think, I think I actually got it backwards there. So the Huawei Nova was the one that looked like a 6P, and the rumor there was that,
you're right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So
Sorry.
Back when the, Pixel, smaller Pixel was supposed to be made by Huawei, the rumor was that was the design they were going to go with. And they kind of paired it with a device that was called the Huawei Meimang 5 in China, which was the larger one of the two, and also had like three other names in China, because that's how they do things over there. And in Europe, they paired the two together, and you had the Nova and the Nova Plus. The specs were very similar, and there were, I think one of the first devices to have the Snapdragon 625, which is, you know, one of the great mid-range chips that are out there right now. The rumor with the Nova 2 and Nova 2 Plus, if we get those, they're, you know, expected the week after I/O. There is a Huawei event that I'll be going to. Not sure we'll be there, but there's a good chance it'll be that phone because there is an event for it in China shortly before. So we'll have a refresh of those. Based on the pictures we've seen out of China, it looks very much like a, you know, kind of taking inspiration from the P10 and, you know, by association taking inspiration for the iPhone, because let's face it, the P10 is a very iPhone-like phone. I think it's going to be a big deal on a few fronts, just because you're refreshing this mid-range line maybe 9-10 months into its lifespan, because we got the Nova last year at IFA, and it's, you know, barely the middle of the year. We're already finding that it's been refreshed potentially. And we also have new chips from Qualcomm to talk about. So we have the 660, which supposedly is going to be powering this. I don't know if, Jerry, if you want to shed a bit more light on that.
It's a nice upgrade. It's nothing unexpected. Daniel, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the biggest upgrades are in the connectivity side. It's got a new modem in it.
Yeah, the 630 is the successor to the 625 and the 626. The 626 we didn't really see in North America. No. It was just a very, very minor clock speed improvement over the 625. But as Alex said, the 625 was in the plus the Nova series. It was famously in the Moto Z Play, which has been a battery darling and one of my favorite devices of last year. And it powers the BlackBerry Key 1 quite well to the same end. It also amazing battery life.
Pretty much every phone that has had this chip has had amazing battery life, which bodes very well for any successes that are built on it.
Doesn't it also run Daydream in the Z Play?
No.
Okay. I wasn't sure
the
which
Z Play
Moto
is,
phone...
an LCD screen.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't support.
Okay, I know which one it is.
Daydream,
now.
But it was the Moto Z.
Right.
But the 630 is actually an interesting. It's the same core layout. It's eight A53s. One the four power cores at 2.2 gigahertz and four at 1.8 efficiency. Four efficiency cores at 1.8 gigahertz. Major upgrades in the baseband. It's the X12. Baseband solution, which was in the 820 series. So this is basically bringing a lot of the same features from the 800 series down to the 600 series. So you get 3x carrier aggregation up to 600 megabits a second. You get a lot of improvements in the Spectra 160 image signal processor. So expect better photos. But yeah, the 660 is really the biggest upgrade. It goes from a 28 nanometer manufacturing process down to a 14 nanometer manufacturing process, which makes it a lot more efficient. It now is powered by the same cryo cores as the 800 series. So the 820 and 835 have these custom Qualcomm cryo cores. Say that 5x fast. And they're not quite as robust, both in terms of clock speed and just sheer technology. But they are based on the same architecture. And they run a new Adreno 512 GPU, the 660, and it has the same baseband improvements. But as Alex said, to go back to that, the 660 should have the same excellent battery life as the 625.
And the big deal there is you're going from a 650 and a 652, which, like you said, were on this earlier, ancient 28 nanometer process. And you had a few decent phones last year that were based upon that, that were based on the 650 or 652. The Xperia X, I think, was one of them, you know, performed well enough. You had A72s in that case, running the performance cores. Now, like you say, you have Qualcomm's own, like, custom cores running the show, and you have 14 nanometer. And for what is coming out of Huawei, a mid-range phone, or a pair of mid-range phones, it bodes really well between the GPU, the radios, and the ISP that with, basically images, looks like these phones are going to have dual cameras, which is one of the major trends in Huawei phones the past year. So it's looking like we're going to get this new pair of mid-range phones from Huawei that probably will outshine last year's flagships. And that's kind of a big deal on a lot of levels.
Yeah. The 660, First off, I don't expect the battery life you see from the 625. Now this will be the 630. The 625 was like a perfection of the core design and the way they wake them up, made just for excellent battery life. It was, you know, the team's working really well together. The 660 cores are going to use a little more juice, even with the smaller fab, because they're better. They're faster. This is going to be better than a Snapdragon 820. So
Terms of battery life or in terms of performance.
They're going to get, you know, the same level of performance that we saw with the 820, and this is on paper, and better battery life. That's why I call it better than the 820. But don't expect a phone that will be able to run for 2 days like the Motos or the new BlackBerry. I want to temper our expectations a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, it's just interesting to bring this all back around to HTC a little bit. We saw them launch the A9 early 2015?
It's late.
Yep. Was it 2016?
Late 2015, I think.
15. Late 2015, yeah.
With the Snapdragon 617. And they, you know, argued that it was a flagship level processor and that you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between that and the HTC M9, which ran the Snapdragon 810.
So the problem,
could. The difference well, you is could. Huge. Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, a couple of things there. So the back in 2015, you're looking at a generation of chips and Android phones that just wasn't that good. You had the 810, which has well-documented issues. You had the 617, which is based on the 615, which was an old chip at the time and had the 28-nanometer process and like 8 A53s, which just was unmanageable and had to be clocked back. And yeah, to HTC's credit, they did a good job with the 617 in the A9. But one thing it didn't have, and like the glaring, fatal flaw with that phone, was the battery life.
Yep.
And that's where the next generation, the 625, and then going now into the 630, really fixes that just through, you know, more advanced manufacturing process.
Right, and I think this will be the first time, perhaps, that a chip in the 600 series could at least stand in for an 800 series.
Agreed. Yeah, I want to get a phone that has that chip just so I can check it out for myself. It's a big deal because, you know, Moore's law, things can. If you're an electronics nerd, you understand that this is what we want. We want something that's not as power hungry, but overperforms. And it sounds like the 660 may be the beginning of that. And that's kind of cool.
And you talked to Michael Fisher, Mr. Mobile, has praised the 625 and the phones that he's used it in because it has hit exactly that sweet spot of power and performance.
Yep.
Where it's just powerful enough that a 1080p Android phone will run fantastically well on it. But at the same time, it has that, it's A53s, which are relatively efficient cores. It's the 14-nanometer process. And it's also the way those cores interact, like you said, switch on and off, that just makes for, very efficient, but also at the same time delivers that performance that previous 600 series chips maybe haven't.
Yeah, I was worried about the 625 because of the 617. When it first came out, I was, this is just PR speak. It's going to be a dog. It's going to be horrible. And I'm very, very glad that I was wrong because that's what everybody needs. Let's be honest, unless you buy a new Note or something that you want to do extreme things with. The 625 is like perfect for a smartphone.
And the 625 can record 4K video. It can run most games pretty well. Stick 4 gigs of RAM in there with it, and it's good for 99% of things that most people want to do on a smartphone.
Qualcomm, I doubted you, and I'm sorry.
Speaking of 625, while we're on the topic, another leak that happened recently is of the Moto Z Play 2.
Jesus.
Moto Z 2 Play.
I wish there's a Sprint and then a trademark symbol in that name somewhere too.
Epic 4G.
Yeah, that's just
So this phone looks like it's going to be
a downgrade. Do you want to explain it, Alex? A downgrade from last year. I mean, come on. They have a
625.
They're going from a 625 rumored to a 6. Well, yeah, rumored to be going from a 625 to a 626. I forget offhand what the RAM was, but the biggest deal
It's 4 gigs.
4 gigs. Okay, so they're going up there, which is okay. Fine, fair enough. But in exchange for those 4 gigs of RAM, you are taking a significant cut in terms of battery capacity and therefore battery life, because you know, there's not much difference between a 625 and a 626 in terms of power consumption. And I think that's going to make a lot of people sad. It's going to make Michael Fisher sad, frankly, which, you know, is the only thing that matters in when you're talking about phones, really.
And you're going to be able to directly compare it to last year's, because RAM, as far as battery life, RAM doesn't affect your battery life. It's not going to be as good simply because the battery isn't as big. And a direct comparison, the newer product should probably be better, but this one's not going to be.
And yeah, it's weird that they chose the Play name for this, where, you know, the past two Play products, even going back to the X Play, which had the, you know, lousy 615, which was not a great chip, but still managed pretty good battery life because it had a massive battery. That was kind of the calling card of the Play series, and now you're moving away from that to the point where it's just basically a cheaper version of the Moto Z line. So, fair enough if that's what they want to do, but I think they're missing out on a trick. Because, you know, Motorola has this track record going into the Force and the Max back in the days of being able to effectively market battery life as a differentiator. And it just seems weird that they're moving away from that now.
Could that
and
be
it's
a
not
little
like the Z Play is chunky.
True.
You know, it's not like this generation, you look at it and go, oh, I need this to be 4 or 5 millimeters thinner. It's a big phone compared to the Z.
But
the Z is 5.6 millimeters.
Yeah, it's tiny. You almost need to put a case or a mod or something on there to be able to hold it properly.
So going to that, I mean, it looks like it will have the new shape of the fingerprint sensor that we first saw on the Moto G5 and G5 Plus, which is a good thing. It'll still support mods. It'll have that same 5.5-inch 1080p display, because Motorola is basically... And it's interesting, they've put themselves in a position where they have to keep the phones the same relative size mm-hmm. for the next couple of years to support the mods.
Which is a good thing.
A great thing.
Yeah, let's not think that's a bad thing. It's good that a company didn't just say, ah, screw it, like another company from Korea who really loved attachments for just a few months and then now hates them.
They were never really invested in it.
No. Yeah, and they never gave any commitment at the time in any way, shape, or form to that. But yeah, fair enough, and you know, good on Motorola for doing that. But it does tie their hands to a certain extent, not just with the new Play, but with the Z2, and eventually that arrives, because the back panel has to match up exactly with a series of products which already exists, and that does limit your design options, not least to do with the camera and the size of the camera module and everything else.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that there's probably... some Lenovo corporate, you know, insight into these phones this year, whereas last year it was probably not there. You know, Lenovo is a bigger company who wants to maximize profits, and they aren't afraid to try different and new things to get there. So, you know, smaller battery, we got to keep it the same size to use the mods, but we can do this and this, let's try it. That sounds like something a bigger company would do.
But let's just take a step back for a second and say what is actually better about this phone. So it's thinner, well. Okay? It has an extra gig of RAM. Everything else is the same or worse. And I don't really see, just based on those things, why this phone needs to exist. Not least because you have a 626 in there, just as the successor to that chip and the chip above it is being released. It seems a really weird time to release that kind of phone, and just it seems to be like out of step with where you would think they would want to be based on where the components are.
I see it as a Lenovo decision. Let's make this one as good, you know, but cheaper for us
I
to
can
build.
I can see big sarcastic air quotes around good there, Jerry.
Well, I mean, you know, in their eyes, maybe these differences aren't going to make that much of a difference. But, you know, it's cheaper to build this. So that makes it a good thing. We're going to continue this product line. We're not making the expensive one now. We're making one that's $10 cheaper to make. And if we sell just as many, we make more money. That you got to think like a company.
And honestly, probably still gets better battery life than the Z or the Z2.
Sure. Sure. It's,
and,
it's,
and the other thing, sorry, ahead, the other thing to keep in mind is that the value proposition is increasingly around mods, not around the phones themselves. Yep. So if you think about it, the thinner Moto Z Play 2 is basically there to sell you a battery mod that will be together the same girth of the original Moto Z Play. And if you look at the year-to-year iterations of the Moto G line, between years 1 and 2, there was not a whole lot of change. Between year 2 and 3, there was a massive change, not necessarily in terms of design, but in features. From year 3 to 4, there is a big design change, but not necessarily a big feature change. And then with year 5, it's the design again. So Motorola is not the company that redesigns and completely redoes its phones every year. It's more like, I think, like a MacBook some sort of other laptop line, which is minorly refreshed every year and just maintains the same price, and or maybe goes down in price a little bit.
Maybe, but there's a lot in terms of refreshing products across, you know, in a lot of different areas that Apple can get away with that basically no one else can. And I'm not sure that acting like Apple really is in the best interest of Motorola. We'll see. We've got to see what they do with the Z2 further down the line.
I'm going to bet that Motorola sells more phones than Apple sells MacBooks in 2017. So
you'd think so. I mean, they only Apple only sells 4.5 million laptops a year. So
I mean,
No, that's not true. 4.5 million a quarter.
Right. I don't mean that they sell bad or that they're a bad product, but phones are a little bit more disposable than a laptop. So to me, it makes perfect sense to try to maximize your profits on a thing that people will be needing to buy. People will need to buy a phone this year. So if we can present a phone that looks good and we can get the right kind of hype behind it, and we can make a little bit more money than we did last year, we're looking good. That's, you know, these companies are smart. That's why they're still in business and why my failed personal little company is not in business anymore. It's just economics. Where's Andrew?
Well, it's also because selling marijuana in the state of West Virginia is illegal.
Whoa, Jerry, so. Hold up. No.
Okay.
No.
All right. That's a bad joke.
That's a segue into something else.
Move too far away, I want to talk about the name U11.
Okay.
Alex, you might get where I'm going. This phone in Northern Europe is named after a German submarine that tried to kill people that live in Great Britain in the 40s and is now sunk off the coast of Copenhagen. That's dumb.
I'm going to have to Google that. The first thing that came to mind to me is like a kid's football team, because U generally means under, and then you have the age. So I don't know. But, I just think, I mean, on the face of it, it's no less meaningless than any like letter plus number combination that we deal with in any smartphone. I'm just, on the one hand, surprised that they didn't go from 10 to 20, given it's their 20th anniversary this year. HTC as a company seemed a bit weird to just go to 11. 11 is a clunky number anyway because it's too many syllables in English. And U just doesn't really, I mean, it's not really a, it's not an X or a T or an S. It's not really a glamorous letter. U in your main high school examinations in the UK is the lowest grade that you get if you fail a subject, just FYI. So it's, yeah, I mean,
I have a hard time understanding why a company would name a device that they want to sell worldwide after a German submarine.
I mean, if you follow the rumors, originally it was going to be HTCU. That was just going to be the name. And then eventually it evolved into U11 because they wanted to bring the old, you know, 8, 9, 10 brand into it. A lot of this is just classic HTC, I think. I went into a briefing for the M8, thinking the name was just HTC1. And days later, they changed it to HTC1 M8. And I was like, what the hell? We had posts in the back on AC that just called it the new HTC1, and we had to edit all that stuff. So they are not averse to making like sweeping branding changes at the last minute. I don't know. I think that they're all in on this UNA now. I'm not big on HTCU in general. It goes back to that press release that first announced the HTCU series, and you know, it was this almost like poetic list of statements involving the letter U in place of Y.
You're doing a huge disservice to poetry by saying that.
But this is only part of it, but it struck me as something, as a concept and an execution that had come from, that tried to have a clever play on the English language, but was written by a non-native English speaker, and it just kind of smacked of, okay, we come up with this really clever thing where U is like you, and we're going to base our entire brand around it, when it's like, no, the internet was doing this like 15 years ago. So I'm not big on the brand in general. I think, you know, the way they're positioning it now, supposedly, according to the rumors, is it's just U11, which is fine. It's a letter. It's a number. Every smartphone is a letter plus a number. You know, if
it's 26 letters and infinite amount of numbers, I don't understand why they would say, no, we're not naming it after a Nazi submarine. that's insane.
You may want to send the executive team an email, because they may not know that.
I did not know that it was a Nazi submarine, to be fair.
Well, you knew that, but
I knew about U-boats, yeah.
Were a thing, so I would think that if you're going to name a product U something, you should at least look.
But I was not around, yeah, I mean, I was not around in 1935. Probably neither was anyone else that's going to be buying this phone. So,
yeah. I just want the next one to be why you know by me.
Yeah. There is a question to be asked there around. I mean, there must be branding conversations that are had around which letter is best for your phone. If you're going to go with your name, HTC, plus a letter, plus a number, there must be better options than you, right? I mean,
you know, I kind of like just HTC 10.
I mean, my prediction was HTC 20. It's their 20th year this year.
Yeah, that would have been great. You know, then again, as I alluded to earlier, I suck at being a businessman, and I also suck at marketing. So,
well,
And I suck at jokes. So there you go.
No, that was a good joke. Don't worry about it.
Listen.
If you're listening, Dad, I ain't selling weed, man. He's just joking. Don't come down here and whoop my butt.
And definitely not out of the Nazi submarine.
Yeah. Where is it? Where is it sunk?
I need to load
off the coast. Off the coast of, well, just north of Hamburg on the coast. The closest place would be Copenhagen in Denmark. Mm.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's move on. Let's talk a little bit about another phone that's going to be inevitably launching in early June. We know a little bit about this, maybe even more than we do about the HTC U11. The OnePlus 5, the company has come out and confirmed both the early summer announcement and the name. Alex, what do we know about the next OnePlus?
So you pretty much covered it right there on that intro tale. We know it's the OnePlus 5. We know it's not the OnePlus 4. The reason for that is in China and some other Asian cultures, number 4 is considered unlucky because it sounds like the Chinese word for death. So they're skipping that. You know, incidentally, Samsung has also skipped the number 4, not in its product names, but in its code names, in its model numbers, rather. So the Galaxy S8 this year, they jumped from 930 to 950. There was no 940. That's just you know, something that happens. We know it's the 5. We know it's coming out sometime this summer. They've not said when, but based on the fact they're kicking off the hype season now for this phone, would suggest that we're probably maybe a month or so out from this eventually appearing. beyond that, all the information we have on this phone comes from, you know, EXIF data and photos of dubious origin, and also benchmarks and that kind of thing. There are a few assumptions you'd maybe be able to draw. Of course, it's going to be Snapdragon 835. There have been rumors around whether it's going to be 6 gigs and 128 or 8 gigs. You know, supposedly there's an 8 gig version for China, which, you know, a lot of other manufacturers this year have had a 4 gig version for the rest of the world, for international markets, for the US, and in China, where they're, you know, sensitive to numbers and more RAM is better, they would go with 6 gigs. OnePlus is saying, no, supposedly, if these rumors are to be believed, they're going to go with 8 gigs in China just because they can. That would be kind of hilarious to see. The other big rumor kicking around is that they're going to have dual camera this time. And there's really no more information that is, you know, reliably surfaced on that. Of course, when you're doing dual cameras in a smartphone, there are a lot of different possibilities there. You could go wide angle, you could go zoomed in, like the G6 and the iPhone do respectively. Or you could go the Huawei route and just use that extra lens to pick out more detail, more contrast. I mean, given the extent to which OnePlus has managed to get a lot of performance out of kind of a run-of-the-mill sensor with the OnePlus 3 and 3T, it bodes well. If they're doing something with a dual camera in the 5, you know, I'm interested to see what that something is.
And the competition, if you come out with a dual camera on your phone right now, it has to be as good as what Huawei or LG is doing, and they're both doing really good. So that's... They well, must think, Jerry, that they've got it.
What configuration would you prefer? I mean, would you prefer the depth sensor?
I like the G6 and the new iPhone. I like the way that you can get
right,
the wider.
But those are two different things. One is a wide angle, and one's a, you know, a portrait. Do you want which one of those two? I guess which one would you prefer?
I like the wide angle. That's just what I prefer. I mean, that's me. That's the way I like to take pictures. It would be awesome if they could build both into a phone in the future.
Three cameras. Why not?
Right. But I think, and not only from my perspective, I think if I was making it, I would try to make it so it does really good wide angle shots, because there's a lot of customer appeal there.
Yeah, and that's been one of the biggest things that I've missed in the past 2 or 3 weeks, going from an LG G6 to a Galaxy S8. Both phones have really, really good main cameras, but I miss, you know, if I'm, you know, find myself somewhere that has a great view, or, you know, in a like an office building or a hotel or a bar or something, somewhere to get that massive wide angle view. You can do it in panorama on a Galaxy S8, but it's just not the same as being able to hit a button and immediately capture the entire scene.
And, you know, when you're taking pictures that you're going to save or share, panoramas are cool. But, you know, I want pictures that are, you know, the same as all my other pictures, the same format, the same aspect ratio. I want them to, you know, just be pictures. I don't want to have to take a panorama. So I like the wide angle.
Something that's kind of interesting, and I guess we'll see if anyone eventually does this. It's a concept that was mentioned to me by someone involved in this industry. You have, you know, zoom lenses and wide angle lenses, and you have 360 cameras now. At some point, someone's got to try sticking a 360 camera into a phone and combining it with a selfie camera. So you have a camera on the front, camera on the back, and you don't have to carry around a separate 360 camera. The 360 camera is in your phone. And the convenience aspect there is just beyond anything that you currently have in a standalone camera.
Skype lag. I thought you were finished. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. Go ahead, Jerry.
I got a sales pitch from a company last year. It was on Kickstarter, and unfortunately it failed to meet its goal, and they're gone. It plugged into the headphone jack for power, and it paired with your phone Bluetooth, and it was a 360 camera the size of a golf ball.
Mm-hmm.
So they can shrink that technology down that small. If we could have a bigger phone with a rounded top, sure, we could put a 360 camera in it.
So what you really need is you need your main camera, your secondary lens for extra detail, your wide-angle lens, your zoom lens, and your 360 lens at the same time. That's all we need in a single...
You need another lens that uses the same IR technology as the iris scanner in the S8.
Right.
To nail the edge detection and sharpness.
There you go.
This is why we don't make phones, and we're not good businessmen, and we're not marketing.
It'd be like an inch.
Hey, speak for yourself.
It'd be like an inch thick and sell for $2,000 if this phone existed.
And that's why we have companies like, it's on the tip of my tongue. The one that Derek and Mr. Mobile reviewed, the $6,000 phone.
Oh, yeah, Virtu.
Virtu, yeah.
Virtu, yeah. Well, there's a market for it, right?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, and that whole luxury smartphone space is very interesting. And I think it'll be interesting to see what direction that advances in as maybe they start, to, like the low end of that space starts to converge with the very high end of normal phones like a Galaxy S8. Maybe we're not there just yet, but 2-3 years down the line, be interesting to see.
Well, you know, and not too long ago, I was shopping for a laptop in a year ago or so. And I was talking with my wife, and I spent the extra money and got a fully decked out MacBook Pro with the discrete graphics card and everything. And it was way too much money, but I love it, and I would do it again. And I could see myself doing the same thing for a phone. If it just was over the top and had everything that I wanted and did everything, I would spend an extra $600-$700 on it.
Yeah, and there's been an argument, especially in the Apple space, that Apple should make a super high-end iPhone.
Absolutely.
That's one of the rumors this year, right? That you have the refresh of the 7, refresh of the 7 Plus, and then you have this crazy bezel-less iPhone that's this kind of anniversary edition that's off on a separate plane in terms of pricing and everything else. Not quite the same thing, but also not impossible that Apple, especially given their history with the Apple Watch, would maybe go out and try and do this aspirational iPhone at some point.
I definitely think they should. It would sell. They would sell Jerry, as many actually, of them.
I want to talk about something that you mentioned. That, you know, with the OnePlus 3T, there was a $40 difference, right? There was a minor spec bump between the 3 and the 3T.
Right.
And there was a $40 cost increase. And you're also mentioning that, you know, yes, it's a faster phone with a bigger battery, but component prices are also going up throughout the industry.
Yes.
And that is something that, you know, may have contributed to the $100 increase in price between the Galaxy S7 Edge and the Galaxy S8.
Sure.
Or the Galaxy S7, rather, and the Galaxy S8. And other companies as well are going to either have to eat the cost of these increased component prices or pass them along to the customer. With the OnePlus 3T and the upcoming OnePlus 5, there's kind of an upper limit, I think, that OnePlus has set for itself in the market. What do you think that price is? Because I don't know if it can go much higher than $440 without alienating some of its core users.
I agree, but I think they're almost going to have to. I think we better get ready to see the OnePlus 5 retail of, you know, $579, $550. And that's because if Samsung has to jack a price up and the amount of parts they buy, you know, has eaten into their profit, OnePlus doesn't buy nearly as many parts. They're not going to be able to get as good a deal with the suppliers. And that means that each individual part is going to cost them a lot more than it costs Samsung. And they have to make money. They cannot make a phone and not make money. Only Google can do that because they made money other ways. OnePlus has to make a profit. And I think rather than, you know, an upper limit on the price, they have a bottom limit on how, you know, how much profit we have to have unless, you know, we're just not going to make it if we can't get, you know, maybe 15% markup at least.
I think that could be part of the reason why maybe you're looking at a 6 and an 8 gig model and maybe a 64 and a 128. You kind of see OnePlus getting into the strategy of repositioning the 3T as that budget offering now, because they've sold out and are not going to be replenishing supplies of the 128 gig 3T. So that's gone for good now. So you'd imagine when the 5 arrives, that would be the premium one. Maybe you'd have the entry level tier of 6 and 64. You want to spend that much more. You want to be, you know, that guy who has an 8 gig phone. Then you pay a bit more, and that's the idea, is to upsell you on that. So you have like 3 tiers. You have the 3T, which becomes the budget offering in air quotes. You have the your base model OnePlus 5. And then you have, you know, they tweak around the pricing maybe so that the 128 or plus 8 gig OnePlus 5 is priced at a point that it works really well for them in terms of margins, but also is attractive to the kind of people like their core audience who really want the best specs.
Yeah, that would be a smart strategy. And we can't forget that, not that these companies are in collusion to fix prices or anything, but OnePlus knows what, you know, the sweet spot for price is going to be from other companies too. Motorola, OnePlus, Xiaomi, Huawei, they all know that we can make a good phone right around this price range and people will think it's a good value. So they all know what that sweet spot for the price is and what it will be. So that's got to be part of their goals too.
Yeah. I mean, every OnePlus phone has inched up in price over the years.
I can remember when milk was 99 cents for a gallon. Everything goes up eventually. Phones have to too, and we can hate it, but if the company doesn't make money, they won't make phones next year.
Sure. I mean, that is fine. I mean, you're talking about milk necessarily being pegged to inflation and all that, but the average, it's taken years for the Galaxy S line to go up in price. It was $650 or $690 or $699 every year for how many years?
And
now it's $750.
And supposedly Samsung was still increasing their profit margin because they just got better at making them.
Right.
So they were still making more money each year, you know, in theory. We don't know this for sure. And, you know, that's another thing Apple does well. They use Alex's idea of upselling. They make a product that's outrageously expensive and then make you want to buy it. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of ways
they
can... Right, right.
So does Google. Right, that 32-gig pixel that isn't going to last you for all your photos.
So there's, you know, there's lots of ways that they can make more without just putting it into the price. But I still would not be shocked to see, you know, a $75 to $100 price increase.
Well, I don't know. That's crazy. That's a lot of money, but yeah, it's possible.
I would bet somewhere in the $500 to $550 US dollar range, probably for the 5 at launch.
And you know what? We can't hate that. Trust me, if OnePlus could sell that phone for $1 and make money, they would, because you would buy it for $1. If, you know, they put a price on it, there's a lot more behind it than they just want to gouge us.
And OnePlus is about more than just selling you a cheap phone now. I think that's been, we've talked about the narrative of OnePlus finally maturing over the past year. That's a big part of it as well. And the 3T has finally been, and maybe that was part of the point of the 3T coming out last year and slowly creeping up there in price, that actually it starts to establish OnePlus as a brand that you're maybe willing to spend $475 or whatever on, because they're reaching parity in terms of quality in a lot of ways, with software, with speed, with build quality, with a lot of the more established brands that you would find in a carrier store. And if the products are as good, then maybe the core audience won't mind paying that much for a 5. We'll see.
Well, I mean, the OnePlus 3T was, I people are going to kill me, but that was probably as good or better than the Nexus 6P. Wouldn't you agree, Alex?
Oh, yeah, for sure. It was way better phone than the 6P.
Yeah, so, you know, the OnePlus makes good stuff. They always have, and the company's getting their act together. I think that the problems they had in India is what they needed to just kick them in the rear end and say, okay, we're not a startup anymore, and we have to start being, you know, emulating what a big company does.
Yeah.
And I think they did.
You also see that. You see that in the carrier deals they're making.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Not in the US, but in the UK, in Finland, a lot of countries in Europe, in India. OnePlus is becoming an aspirational brand that lives alongside Samsung. And Alex, you wrote about how when you go to OnePlus, it's not just about OnePlus.net. It's not just about buying a phone. It's about buying a bag. It's about buying various very, very high profit margin accessories accompany that.
And I did put that to the co-founder of OnePlus, Carl Pei, and he kind of downplayed the importance of accessories and of all the stuff that accompanies the brand. But I think I still think that's a huge part of like the OnePlus project, if you like. It starts off with the enthusiasts, but then you got to buy a case, you got to buy accessories. Accessories that kind of apparel is all way higher margin than a commodity smartphone. And as much as they may want to make it about making the best smartphone, and you're part of that because you're on brand with OnePlus, ultimately the just a Samsung will make money selling you a $50 case. OnePlus will make decent margins on maybe a slightly lower priced case. Going back to the brand side of things, you unbox any OnePlus phone, you have a note in there from Carl Pei. You get any OnePlus review kit comes with all the branded stuff that comes with it. You got the bag, the case, the official leather strap for the thing. It's all about getting you on board with the idea of this up and coming brand. And I think that's been kind of the genius that OnePlus has had, whereas maybe Honor on the Huawei side has been lacking that to a certain extent.
I remember when I got OnePlus One, and I opened the box and I took the phone out, and then it had a flat cable. It had a nice set of earphones, and then I looked at a Galaxy S5, and it had just a cheap 3-foot crappy cable and really horrible headphones. There can't be much of a price difference there, but when I opened the OnePlus One, I got a nice feeling because everything inside the box was really good.
And another thing about you talk about accessories, dash charge is another part of that. If you want to look at, OnePlus could easily license Quick Charge from Qualcomm. It would probably be cheaper if OnePlus did license Quick Charge from Qualcomm, given what we know about that situation. But the fact they do their own thing, that has to play into the whole, first-party accessory thing. To get dash charge to work, you not only need the charger and the phone, you also need the cable. Part of that is to do with the way the regulations for cables and certain amperages in the EU. So there are like safety issues there as well.
Yep.
But it also ties into you want to charge your phone as fast as you can charge it. You've got to buy the cable from OnePlus. You've got to have the charger from OnePlus, and that is the only place you can get that cable. And you got to they're making a decent amount of money when you buy a replacement because you lost your dash charge cable at the airport or something.
Right.
I like that they'll sell me a laptop bag or a little miniature drone, but man, I hate that proprietary charging nonsense.
Like I said, it's not all just cynical price gouging. They have to make a separate cable because that's the way the rules work. But it certainly doesn't hurt them financially that they have to do that.
No, and from company's side, it's smart.
Mm-hmm.
It's smart to do it the way they do it.
So I was going to say, we're an hour in. Shall we talk Google I/O?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to be in California on the ground next week, and we'll obviously talk about all the announcements. But I think for the last few minutes, let's just lay out a little bit about what to expect. The keynotes early Pacific on Wednesday the 17th. We know that we'll see the first beta of Android O. Alex and Andrew are clamoring for some information about what it'll do to tablets and perhaps improve on the Chrome side, Jerry. Alex, what are you most excited about seeing?
I mean, you mentioned Android O. That's going to be a big part of it for me. They were very clear in the first Android O alpha release, that the first developer preview, that more features were coming. So I think it'll put some meat on the bones there in terms of what direction the next version of Android will take and what the big user-facing features will be. For me, though, I want to know what Google's up to with convertibles and laptops and tablets, because obviously something's up there. If you look at 7.1.2 or the current Android O preview on a Pixel C, they're building out this slightly differentiated task switching thing, which ties into the whole windowed mode that they have, and you know, the picture-in-picture mode that is now on Android O.
They're turning Android into Windows.
Well, slowly but surely.
Exactly what they're doing, yeah.
Yeah, and Jerry, you can. I'll pass the baton over to you on this. But one of the big things that we've been talking about internally, and that there's been a lot of speculation on, I think Ars Technica had an article on this week, is around Fuchsia and around Andromeda and around. Okay, what is the future of, you know, Google on a laptop or a tablet or a convertible?
Yeah.
And also, what is the future of Google on everything if they're building out this whole separate OS? And Jerry, consider yourself on the hook for
we're excited, and a lot of people are excited about what Andromeda, Fuchsia, what it's all going to be. We need to also understand that it may not be anything. This is all speculation, and nothing official has been said other than, yeah, we're having fun seeing if we could build an OS from scratch. The guys building it are from, some are from Google, some are from Apple. You've got people from, you know, old time Unix operating systems. There's a lot of great people doing a lot of good work. And what we've got so far is it's a kernel. You know, it's if you know a little bit about how Android works, it's the kernel is like the brain. That's the hard software, or that talks to all the hardware itself, and then all the other software talks to the kernel. They're building a new kernel, and it's what's called a microkernel. It'll be more efficient, and then it's easier to add stuff, which would be make it easy to update. On top of it is just it's a new way to make a user interface. That way already exists. If you can go to the Play Store and you search for flutter.io, it's an app that's a demo of all this stuff. You can make an app for the iPhone or for Android and probably even for Windows or Mac right now and use this kit. Uses the Dart language. And it looks really great. Animations are super smooth. And it's really cool, but this is nowhere near anything finished. This is not, you know, this is something you can put on your phone to demonstrate. This is not anything you can use now. And we really are only speculating on how this will work into the future. But this user interface, it's infinitely scalable. It would look good on a small 4-inch phone, something, you know, like the iPhone SE, and it would look good on the side of a building in Times Square. That's something that has to happen for the future, and, you know, Google is all in on that part of the project. Let's make something that's beautiful, scalable, and works everywhere.
Well, that sounds pretty damn great.
It does, man. I mean, I'm trying to hold back because I don't want to, you know, I don't want everybody to think that this is coming, because that dude, Jerry, said it's coming. We don't know if it's coming, but man, is it great. And if it happens, it's one operating system that installs on your Chromebook, installs on your desktop, installs on your phone. Everything is the same except the user interface.
And installs on your phone is the key thing here, because if you have an operating system that runs across all those three devices that you just mentioned, no one's going to want a laptop that is only guaranteed updates for 2 years, that, you know, needs to get passed through your carrier, through your device manufacturer, through all these other channels. So if you fix the update problem on a phone or a tablet, it's basically automatically applied to the phone. That could be huge for, you know, avoiding the biggest kind of built-in weakness that Android's had since its inception.
Well, we think of that as a weakness, and
I mean, it is a weakness, right?
It's right. But now a lot of people that I've talked to is, well, yeah, it's not ideal, but we're making tons of money. We, you know, this works. That attitude is there, whether we like it or not. That's, mm-hmm. You know, this is working. We can hate it, but it works. So that, you know, may not be the primary goal here, because I think the primary goal is we do not want to make the same mistake that they think, and I think, that Microsoft is making, but in reverse. Microsoft's idea of a universal operating system that runs on everything is awesome. The problem is the phone.
Yeah, they're irrelevant in mobile. They can't.
Right.
Yeah.
You can't run, desktop Photoshop on a phone, no matter how powerful it is, because it's a tiny touch interface. That means that the interface for any app needs to be able to scale.
So, Jerry, assuming Google isn't going to talk about Andromeda, Fuchsia, Flutter, any of that at I/O, because it's probably unlikely. What do you think will be the main announcement, the main focus at the developer conference this year?
I think the biggest thing from Google's end is going to be Android O. We're going to see more. There's a lot of hidden things that people have uncovered that aren't really there, but you can make it happen in the alpha software that they've given. The beta is going to show us some of this stuff as it's finished. But then I think we're going to see a lot of stuff about web apps and Polymer and instant apps and stuff that isn't exactly Android, because that's just a big thing right now. And it all ties in together. A well-coded web app and an Android instant app, I think we all can see how those two things could be melded together a little bit better to make for a great experience.
And especially with Android apps becoming more common on Chromebooks now.
Yes.
You have the line blurring between a web app on a Chromebook and an Android app. And, maybe in the future, whether it's on a Chromebook or whether it's on an Andromeda laptop or something of that nature, that line becomes very blurry to the point where, it almost becomes what Java wanted to be on the web way back when, where you just click a thing on the web and suddenly you're into that application, but only in a much more high performance and a much more secure way than Java ever managed to do.
Yeah. And Java had huge goals back then. It was awesome. You have to start somewhere, and this could be, a natural evolution where you have to scrap what you started with and let's do it this way and it's better, but it has to happen. That's part of a future where all the devices can do the same thing. A lot of that is what we can do on the web. So,
well, I'm really excited about seeing what Google Assistant's next step will be. We've seen it roll out to devices running Android 6.0 and above. We've seen it mature in well-used and much-loved services like Google Allo. And in all seriousness, Google Home, which has launched in the US and the UK and a few other countries, alas, not in Canada. But I think Assistant is going to continue to be the backhaul, if you will, of Google's sort of strategy of it, of its knowledge graph everywhere. And it's done such a good job so far, with a few exceptions. You still can't make reminders on your Google Home because, I don't know, there's no human earthly reason why that's still the case almost 6 months later. But regardless, Assistant as a product has improved a lot since it was launched with Allo. And I mean, I love it. I use it all the time.
We had Assistant was the big debut last year, but we also did have Allo and Duo. And there was a lot of hype about it last year. And those two products have both just gone absolutely nowhere. And Google's messaging strategy continues to be kind of a mess. Almost to the point where they have to say something this year and give some kind of clarity to that situation, because both Allo and Duo are kind of a graveyard right now.
And that's being generous.
I don't think they have to. I mean, I think what they can say is, check out this new version of Android and it'll run on this awesome new phone and you can install WhatsApp on it. There's your solution.
Well, that's a non-answer. I mean,
but they don't have to do anything different than they're doing now. They they still like Allo and Duo. We can see from the update. Allo just got a really cool update today. I think they're just going to accept slow adoption and be happy with it.
I also think we don't know the number of people on Allo. Google hasn't disclosed that. And I also don't think that the priority for Allo is North America or Western Europe. I think it's predominantly Brazil and India. And those are two markets where WhatsApp is massive.
Yep. Everybody wants SMS and Allo. And when they announced that something was coming, I did too. But now that I've seen it, they're not going to put SMS in Allo. They don't want to put SMS in Allo because Allo is for people that either can't afford or don't want to send SMS.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, we'll go over everything that was announced at Google I.O. next week. And it's going to be a really cool event. We're all going to be together in the same place. We'll be able to look at each other in the eye when we make poorly thought out jokes to one another. And it'll be a lot of fun. So I'm looking forward to seeing you guys in person.
Should be cool.
Yes.
Well, before we go, we have Mobile Nations is not just one thing. It's a number of different things. And I wanted to draw your attention to a new brand that we've launched in the last few months called Thrifter. You may have seen a few posts on AC sending you to amazing deals at Thrifter. And Thrifter is a really great way to find smart deals every day. And these are curated deals. It's not just some algorithmic list of discounts from Amazon. This is deals that are handpicked by a number of people who do this all day, every day. And if you live in the US and you like to save money on great tech or other things too, I mean, today you can buy a blender for $30 off its retail price. That's sort of techy, but it's certainly not your typical tech deal. And you can actually get all of Thrifter's deals in your inbox every day if you sign up for their newsletter. So if you're interested in tech deals, if you're interested in deals at all, you just want to save a bit of money, go to thrifter.com, sign up for the newsletter, and check it out. All right, well, that's it for today. We'll go around and say a quick goodbye. Alex, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on all the things at Alex Dobe. You can find my stuff on androidcentral.com. The next week, we'll have a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff coming up on, I guess, my personal Twitter, personal Instagram, but also the site accounts, at Android Central on Twitter. At Android Central on Instagram, we'll have behind-the-scenes stuff coming up on our Instagram story there. So chances are, if you look on there, you'll see, images and video of us goofing around at and before and after Google I.O. So, yeah, all of those places.
And Jerry will be one of those people. Where can people find you? I want to see your thoughts.
Right now, you can find me on Twitter. It's at GBHIL. But Flo is going to teach me to Instagram.
Ooh.
I'm going to get an account, even if I have to make a new email address. I'm going to get an Instagram account. And Flo is going to teach me how to Instagram. There will probably be lots of liquor and lots of stupidity involved, but I'll get it eventually.
We may live stream it in our Instagram story or possibly on YouTube or something.
But day 3 of I.O. is going to be Jerry on Instagram. Somehow. It's going to happen.
Well, you heard it here first. It's going to be fun. My name is Daniel Bader. You can find me at JourneyDan on all the things. You can find us all at androidcentral.com. And we will see you next week for a very special live version of the Android Central podcast. Until then, talk to you later.
Adios.
See you later.